The night sky in focus and the latest news from space. This is The Sky Tonight with Pete Singleton and Cambridge astronomers Paul Fellows and Jonathan Clough. Only on HCR 104 FM.
You're listening to The Sky Tonight, looking towards the stars each month on HCR 104 FM.
Good evening to you and welcome to The Sky Tonight, HCR's monthly astronomy show, looking at the stars and discussing the latest events in space. I'm Pete Singleton. I'm joined, as always, by Paul Fellows, chairman of the Cambridge Astronomical Association, and Jonathan Clough, also of the CAA, and both fellows of the Royal Astronomical Society. On this edition, then, we will be looking at the Perseids meteor shower and also some terms that astronomers use. We don't always know exactly what they mean. For instance, what does opposition mean? What is meant by superior conjunction? What's a brown dwarf and what's a white dwarf? So we'll have a little look at that a bit later. Mary Wallace Wally Funk finally becomes an astronaut, courtesy of Blue Origin. Are we witnessing the birth of a moon around a distant planet? And what happened to the ascent stage of Eagle, the Apollo 11 lunar module? And of course, what to see in August's night sky? And when did the first stars actually shine? But first, let's start off then, gentlemen, by welcoming you both. Hello, Paul, and hello, Jonathan.
Hello, Pete.
The Perseids meteor shower. Okay, let's kick off then, Paul. How often do we see the Perseids?
Well, the meteor showers are an annual event. The Perseids happens once a year. Round about this time, it begins in early August, but has its peak on the night of the 11th, 12th of August, but lasts about 2 to 3 weeks. And gradually you see an increasing number of shooting stars, meteors coming into the atmosphere and burning up as the peak arises, and then it falls away again.
What causes a meteor shower, Paul?
It's due to little bits of material that are left behind trailing along the orbit of a comet, and in this particular case, in the case of the Perseids, it's Comet Swift-Tuttle. Comet Swift-Tuttle orbits around the Sun in 133 years, coming into the inner part of the solar system, just inside the Earth's orbit, to a little bit closer to the Sun than we are. And so the Earth can cross through the path of the comet. And in fact, there's a very slim chance that one day it will actually collide with the comet. I think the last time that Swift-Tuttle was passing through the inner solar system was 1992. And on its 133-year orbit, that means the next one is 2126. It's got to go way out beyond Neptune, out into the Kuiper belt, and then gravity will bring it back in again, as I say, in 133 years' time. But astronomers calculate that in the year 3044, so we don't really have to worry too much about this, it's going to have a close pass of the Earth within 1 million kilometres, so not that much further away than the Moon is from the Earth, and that's classed as a near miss. But it's still extremely unlikely that it's going to actually collide at that point.
Yeah.
But what happens is that the heat from the sun causes lots of little bits to fall off the comet. That's what generates the tail of a comet that we see streaming away from the sun, away from the main nucleus, the dirty snowball that makes up the majority of the comet. And those little bits get left behind all along the orbit. And so when the Earth passes through the path of the comet, when their orbits intersect, we get a sudden shower of all of these little comet fragments coming into the Earth's atmosphere at quite high speed, 50 kilometers per second, and burning up high up in the atmosphere. Most of them are so tiny that they've got no chance of surviving and making it to the ground. Any that do make it to the ground, we would call a meteorite. But we don't get very many of those from Comet Swift-Tuttle, because most of the fragments are made of little flecks of ice, perhaps with the odd bit of grit in there, bits of sandy material. So they tend to burn up. They're not really very solid at all.
So turning to Jonathan then, what's the best way to look at these meteors, Jonathan?
It's really quite simple. It is a matter of just looking up. You don't need to look at a particular point in the sky. There is a point in the sky called the Radiant, which is actually in the constellation of Perseids, which is why they're called the Perseids. And that's where they appear to come from. But by their very nature, as Paul said, they're going very fast and they make a streak across the sky. So actually, the worst place to look is at the Radiant, because if you do see one there, it's coming straight towards us. So it'll just appear like a dot. So really, you just look straight up and lie back and enjoy it. It's supposed to be, well, it obviously is much better if the skies are dark. It sounds very obvious. It's like any astronomical object. It's easier to see if there's no light pollution. So you want to get somewhere where there's not too much light pollution. And it's good to choose a time when there's not too much moonlight as well. Mm. Now, we're quite lucky this year because the new moon is on the 8th of August. And the peak for these meteors, the Perseids, is somewhere around the 11th, 12th of August. So it's quite soon after the new moon. I think Paul also said there's actually a chance of seeing them outside the 12th or 13th as well, although that should be the time when they're at maximum. So general advice for meteor showers is get yourself a deck chair or a lounger and a blanket and a flask of hot chocolate or something. Sit back in the garden, get your eyes adjusted to the dark and just watch the sky. And if you do that when the skies are dark, there's a good chance you'll see something, particularly around the 12th to 13th of August.
It might be an idea to jump in the hot tub then, Paul, and observe them from there.
Yeah, that's what I tend to do.
The glass of wine.
Yeah, so just lie back and watch. And you do see one or two in a minute at the peak. So, it's, you know, quite a few of them. They say 50 to 60 an hour for the peak rate, something like that. And it really does work. But as Jonathan says, you need as much darkness as you can get away with.
And once your eyes are adjusted to that, darkness,
I was lucky to,
you know, the more you see, it's
If you just whiz outside to have a quick look, your eyes won't be opened up. You'll have pinpoint pupils, and you won't see anything for about 15 minutes, really.
Yeah, you've got to give it as you say, about a quarter of an hour or so to get used to it, and then sit back and enjoy. Really, and it's something that people can do without any equipment or anything like that. You just sit back.
Yeah, it's best just with the Mark One eyeball.
Yeah. Yeah, often best, indeed. Well, that's great then. It's as I expect that sometimes each session of meteors is better than the previous one. I mean, it just depends, doesn't it? How this dust is burning up in the atmosphere.
They do try to sort of give a weather forecast for it, but it's even worse than the normal terrestrial forecasts. in terms of forecasting whether we're going to go right through the center of the stream or clip the edge of it, depending on the exact dynamics. But I've never found those meteor predictions to be terribly accurate.
No. Okay, then.
It's usually better just to look for a dark sky. So is it this time, this time with the... Sorry, Pete.
Sorry, carry on, Jonathan. Carry on, Jonathan.
I was just going to say, this time, because there's a good new moon, because there's a good new moon near to the point, that's what you say, it should be a good year this year just to have some dark skies. So that's promising.
Good. Okay. Well, we'll look at the what's in the night sky, the rest of the night sky, a little bit later on in the show. But let's just first of all turn to some space news, Jonathan. You're the one with usually the news on that. So what can you tell us? We've had Wally Funk, who's you've finally gone up into space. When we went to air last month, we hadn't actually. I don't think she'd actually gone up, but now she has. Now I hear that NASA could be redefining what the limits of space are. So what's going on here? Does that mean she's not actually been an astronaut at all?
It's a bit naughty of NASA, to be honest. I mean, that NASA have always been the ones who have said that space starts at 80 kilometres or 50 miles up. And anybody who went beyond that point has been given their astronaut wings or whatever they are for by NASA. The rest of the world has a different definition, which is that you have to pass through the Kármán line, which is defined as being at 100 kilometres. But leaving that all aside, NASA had a meeting, and it was actually whilst the New Shepard mission was actually in space, as I understand it. And they're discussing changing the definition slightly, not on the height, but on the what you're doing while you're there. And they're saying that you're only an astronaut if you're doing something to do with the health and safety of the Earth or of the other people on the spaceflight, which basically seems to be trying to rule out anybody who's just a passenger. Mm. I don't think they've made a final decision yet, but it's we'll see where it all goes. I think they might be forced to just leave it as it was, to be honest.
For those of us who don't know, she was one of the original Mercury. Was it the 13, Jonathan?
Yep, the Mercury 13, and
the female, the women.
She was sort of on a sort of promise.
Mm.
Yeah, and sadly, women because went through the same training program and testing.
Yeah, and in those days, of course, it was the men who had priority, and sadly, the women never got to go into space. I think America had to wait till Sally Ride, I think, who was the first American woman in space. But anyway. It was good to see. I mean, I watched the stream, I'm sure you did as well. And it was good to see that how excited she was. And this woman's 82, for goodness sake. Although, you know, she's got many, many thousands of hours of in her aviation career. So I suppose really it wasn't, although it was a milestone for her, it wasn't a terribly scary thing for her. Right, Jonathan, what else have you got for us in space?
Well, it's a number of things. I'll just final point on the Blue Origin flight is it also carried the youngest person who's been to space, who is an 18-year-old. So it actually it has set another record for that as well. Something else we talked about last month was Hubble. We had the trouble with Hubble because it was broken down, and it was actually quite a pessimistic outlook because it looked like the main computer had failed and the backup computer wasn't backing up. So much to my surprise and delight, it actually managed to restart on July the 17th and is now resumed operations. So I think it's an indication that Hubble is nearing the end of its life. Mm. But the good news is there's a little bit of life still in it, and hopefully we'll have a transition to the James Webb Space Telescope later this year. Mm. But hopefully there won't be a gap in between.
Well, I understand. I think we mentioned this last month that the James Webb Telescope won't have as long a life as Hubble has had, Paul.
Well, indeed, one of the problems or situations with the James Webb is that it needs to be cooled in order to carry out its main function, which is to look deep in the infrared part of the spectrum. That's important because if we're looking out into very deep space, looking at things we've not really seen before, the light from them has travelled a long way through the universe over a long period of time and become heavily redshifted by the expansion of the universe, so that light that would have been in the optical or even the ultraviolet part of the spectrum gets shifted down into the infrared. And obviously infrared is heat radiation, so if your spacecraft is not cooled, you tend to drown in a pool of your own heat radiation rather than actually seeing anything. So there's a supply of helium on board that's used as coolant to keep the thing down to just a few degrees above absolute zero in order that it can get its best and sharpest images. Mm. And that's probably enough for a few years, 3 or 4 years of operation. Once it runs out, it'll still be useful as a telescope, but it won't be able to do that deep infrared reach that is really its primary purpose. So I think it'll go on into a second lease of life after that, but it certainly won't then be able to do a lot of the things that it'll do in its early years.
And of course, it's much. It's going to be much further away from us than Hubble is.
That's right. They're parking it out away from the Earth at what's called L2, one of the Lagrange points, which is like a gravitational point of balance, so that the gravity of the Earth and the Sun roughly cancel out and keeps it in a stable position about 1 million miles away from the Earth, whereas Hubble is just 300 miles above the Earth's surface. So was within reach of a servicing mission.
This is The Sky Tonight on HTR 104 FM.
Welcome back to The Sky Tonight, HTR 104 FM's monthly astronomy show. I'm Pete Singleton, and I'm with Paul Fellows and Jonathan Clough from the Cambridge Astronomical Association. Right, we were talking about some space news, Jonathan, so quickly give us one or two other little bits of news, please. SpaceX or whatever.
Yeah, a few snippets. Well, one of the combination of things, we've got the International Space Station, where we did a changeover of a Russian science module. There was something which had been attached to the ISS for 20 years, was taken off and removed from the space station, towed away by one of the Russian cargo ships, robot ships, and burnt up in the atmosphere, and was replaced by a new module called Nauka, which is a 22-ton multi-purpose laboratory module, which will basically give the Russian part of the International Space Station a bit more space. So that was quite interesting to watch. I saw the whole manoeuvre of it docking. But about 3 hours after it docked, it had a malfunction and managed to fire its thrusters, which was a bit unfortunate when you're already attached to the International Space Station. So it pushed the International Space Station a bit out of kilter. And that in turn has led to a delay in the launch of the next test for the Boeing Starliner. That should actually already be up there, but they pushed the launch back. Okay. Should be happening any day now, but it's they're desperate to have this second trial run. If you remember, 18 months ago now, they launched and they failed to get to the International Space Station because there was problems with the software. So they're hoping it's all fixed. So there's a sort of double collection of things there.
The astronauts on the space station weren't in any danger, were they, Jonathan? Sorry. Jonathan.
We got a report back from NASA saying that the astronauts on the space station weren't in any danger at any point, but they wanted to just spend a little bit of time getting the space station settled back down again and make sure it was exactly where they wanted it to, because obviously it was an unexpected and uncalibrated set of emissions from this unit.
Okay, on you go then.
Okay. The odd bit of news, an amateur astronomer has done some calculations using some software which is generally seemed to be okay, looking at particularly back at the Eagle module from the Apollo 11 space mission. And you remember the famous phrase, the Eagle has landed. The Eagle was the ascent module for the lunar lander for the Apollo 11 one. Landing. And it was the unit which brought the astronauts back up to meet up with the command module in orbit. And once they transferred across the command module, met up with Michael Collins again, they jettisoned the Eagle. And it was jettisoned into orbit around the moon. Now, the assumptions and the statement from NASA at the time was that it would have just gradually decayed in orbit and crashed into the surface, but it wasn't tracked. And this amateur astronomer has now come up with some calculations which says there's a fair chance it's still in orbit. And what we need is a little bit of time from some radar systems on Earth to look for it. We may well find it. And I've done a little bit of reading about this, and apparently there's also a chance, they believe, that the lander from the Apollo 10 mission, which of course didn't actually land, but was the test mission. It was the Apollo 10, or maybe the Apollo 8 mission, I'm not sure. But there apparently are a number of other things from the Apollo era which might still be in orbit around the moon. Now, this all sounds very odd to me. I was pretty certain that we'd been told these had either crashed into the moon or disappeared in other ways. But it's an interesting theory. And if the Eagle is actually in orbit and could be recovered by, let's say, a SpaceX spaceship and brought back to Earth, I'm sure it would make a very interesting exhibit in the one of the space museums around the world.
It certainly would, Jonathan. But my question is, I'm sure I remember them saying that they actually recorded the moonquake as the ascent stage did land, you know, a crash to the moon. But maybe that was something else. Maybe that was something else.
I did read up as much as I could on that before this program, and they certainly did do that on later missions. So Apollos 12, 14, and 15, they deliberately crashed it in, and they did it as part of a controlled experiment. And although Apollo 11 did actually put a seismometer onto the surface of the moon, there was no plan to actually crash the Eagle into the surface in a measured way. Plus, that seismometer from Apollo 11 only worked for 3 weeks. So if it had stayed in orbit for more than 3 weeks, they wouldn't have been able to catch it.
Okay, then. Thanks for that, Jonathan. We now must move on. And what I thought we'd do this month, before we start looking at the night sky for August, and Paul, you can come in here. We often use some phrases that you guys probably think, well, everybody knows what that means. But actually, there are some phrases that people may not exactly know what it's meant. Right. Let's look at the word sort of opposition. Paul, what can you tell us about that? And how would you explain that to people who are just starting off on the field of astronomy? Perhaps one of your young members?
Yes, Pete, it's something that I teach to my GCSE students. Opposition means almost what it sounds like. It means opposite.
Yeah.
And it's something that a planet can do. It can be opposite the sun in the sky, so that if the sun is due south and high in the sky during the day, then 12 hours later, the planet will be in a similar position of being due south and high in the sky, because they are opposite. You have all three planets in a straight line. Sorry, all three objects in a straight line: the sun, the earth, and the planet. Now, obviously, that can only happen for those planets that have orbits outside of the earth. So Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, and so on. You can't have either Venus or Mercury being at opposition, because they come between the sun and the earth as they overtake us on the inside. So when we say Jupiter is at opposition, it means that, in fact, the order is Sun, Earth, Jupiter, with the Earth in the middle. And this also means that the distance between the Earth and Jupiter, or whichever outer planet it is the minimum. And that means it's the best possible time to observe it. Mm-hmm. So if we want to get the best view of Mars or Jupiter or Saturn, do so when it's at opposition. It'll be best placed, highest in the sky, and also nearest to us, so it will appear largest and brightest.
What about that word conjunction, and even superior conjunction? Presumably that's a superior conjunction is better than a conjunction.
So there are two types of conjunction in astronomy. You have a superior conjunction or an inferior conjunction.
Right.
And superior conjunction means when the planet is actually on the far side of the sun. So the three objects, again, lined up: Earth, Sun, planet. In this case, that would be a superior conjunction. And that's actually, of course, when the planet is as far away from us as possible. It's on the directly in line, but on the far side of the sun. So it's the completely opposite case to opposition. Opposition is a straight line with the Earth in the middle, and superior conjunction is when the sun is in the middle and the planet is on the far side of the sun. Now, of course, that makes it very, very difficult to see the planet because it will be in the daylight part of the sky. So you don't tend to see them at superior conjunction. But you can have the inner planets be at superior conjunction as well, that they can be on the far side of the sun in a straight line. So that's a term that can be applied to any of the planets, whereas, as I said before, opposition can only be for the outer planets, Mars and so forth, where the Earth can be positioned in the middle of a line of three. Good. And the inferior conjunction, just to complete the set, is where you have either Venus or Mercury passing between the Sun and the Earth. So they are at a conjunction, as in they appear in the same point in the sky, but it's an inferior one because they are close to us and they are in the middle. And that you can observe sometimes.
I suspect the use of the words superior and inferior are probably the original meanings of the words rather than how we often use the words today.
They don't really mean better or worse. They're in terms of distance.
What about brown and white dwarfs? What's the difference between a brown dwarf and a white dwarf?
Very different animals. A brown dwarf is a failed star. Stars are born out of clouds of gas and dust, and you get a gravitational collapse of a cloud of dust and gas that pulls the material in. And if there's enough of it, and then it will generate enough heat in its core from friction and collapse to trigger nuclear fusion. And the smallest type of star would be a red dwarf star, and then an orange dwarf star, and then a yellow dwarf star like the sun, and so on. But if the amount of material is insufficient, then it doesn't get hot enough to trigger that nuclear fusion, and you have a failed star, and that we would call a brown dwarf. Mm. And this sort of a bit of a gray area between a gas giant planet like Jupiter and a brown dwarf. Jupiter is a very, very small brown dwarf in some senses, in that it's mostly made of hydrogen and helium. It's not large enough to generate any nuclear fusion in its core. And what we roughly say is that if Jupiter was 75 times more massive, then it would have become a brown dwarf. And it would then need to go on to be about 1,000 times as massive before it would have become a red dwarf star, something like that.
Okay. Perhaps, Jonathan, you'd like to have a shot at pulsars and quasars. We often hear this.
I'll give it a go.
Well, we can always bring Paul in if you get stuck.
No, it's okay. But I say it's a little bit like the difference between a brown dwarf and a white dwarf. Although they sound very similar, they're actually very different animals again. I'll start with the quasar. The name comes from the phrase quasi-stellar object. So quasar has been rolled together to a quasi-stellar object. And it's actually the extremely luminous active center of a galaxy. And so every galaxy has a supermassive black hole at the center, or at least the vast majority of them do. There's been one or two exceptions found. And if the black hole is very active, that is, it's eating things and it's bringing things in, it will have an accretion disk around it, which will glow and be very, very hot. And a very active galactic nucleus will actually start to spin at a very high speed. The accretion disk will actually start to create a beam, which will beam on two planes, above the disk and below the disk. And if we happen to get lined up so that we can actually be see this beam, which is sort of emitting from the center of the active galactic nucleus. We see this extremely luminous light source, and that is what a quasar is. It's the center of a galaxy which is very active. A pulsar is a very different beast. It's actually derived from a star which has collapsed and down onto itself and formed a type of star we call a neutron star, which is very, very, very dense. And in the act of collapsing down and moving from a very large object to a relatively small object, any spin it has is magnified and it starts to spin very, very quickly. And it also usually has a very high magnetic field. This is, therefore, a very compact, very dense, very rapidly spinning star. And it's this high rate of spin and the magnetic field creates this thing, which once again can be detected by us. And it can be a very, very rapid pulsing, which can be picked up by radio telescopes. So we have a very small, very rapidly spinning object emitting magnetic pulses, which is the pulsar. And we have a very active, very large object, which is the active galactic nucleus of a galaxy, which is giving us the quasar.
Good. OK, gents. Well, I think we can perhaps come back to this in the future shows.
The Night Sky in Focus and the latest news from space. This is The Sky Tonight with Pete Singleton and Cambridge astronomers Paul Fellows and Jonathan Clough. Only on HCR 104 FM.
Welcome back to The Sky Tonight from HCR 104 FM. I'm Pete Singleton with Paul Fellows and Jonathan Clough. All right, gentlemen, the night sky for August. Where do we start? Perhaps with Jupiter and Saturn in opposition. Paul?
Yes, so we talked about the definition of opposition. Mm. So the Earth is catching up with the two giant planets and due to overtake them on the inside, that puts them at their best possible position for observing as they're closest to us. The first is going to be Saturn, and that's lying low in the south in the constellation of Capricorn, will be just a few tens of degrees above the horizon, so you'll need quite a clear southerly horizon to be able to spot it, and that will pass by as the Earth passes us on the inside. We'll get the best view of it, and then a couple of weeks later the same occurs with Jupiter in the next constellation along in the zodiac, the constellation of Aquarius. Mm. And Jupiter, I've already seen it this season, shining very, very brightly. So looking forward to opposition and getting the telescope on it and really getting some good views. It will be fairly low in the sky again. Aquarius is never the best place to find things, but a little bit higher up than Saturn. So we're hopeful for some good views. Okay. If you move on just a little bit, if you want to have a bit more of a challenge, they'll be followed by Neptune. Mm. And that's a bit of a test for anyone with a modest sized telescope. You can just about make it out as a small blue dot. And then later on in the night, still quite low in the east during this month, you'll be able to pick up planet Uranus as well. So the four giant planets are lined up. Saturn, Jupiter, Neptune, Uranus across the sky. Saturn will be best placed first, and then just work your way through the four of them.
Okay. Jonathan?
Well, just finish off the planet set, because as Paul says, all of the planets this month are very low. However, there should be some good views to be had. And the one which we haven't talked about is Venus, which will be visible soon after sunset. Very bright, but also very low and difficult to see. So if you don't have a very clear horizon, you might find it difficult to see. If you want a guide to help you find it, we talked about the looking for the Perseids. Well, if you're out looking for the Perseids on the nights of the 10th and 11th, and there's a very, very new moon, just a very small crescent moon, then you should see Venus very close to the moon in the evenings of the 10th and the 11th. So there's a chance to try and see them together.
That's good. Anything for deep sky objects, Paul?
Well, this is a good time of year to have a bit of a tour around. Start off with the summer triangle, of course. That's three bright stars in three different constellations. It's Vega in the constellation of Lyra, Deneb in Cygnus, and Altair in Aquila the Eagle. Quite widely spaced, but three very bright stars. They're usually the first three that you can see high above your head as it gets dark. So it's worth trying to pick out and work out which those are, because they make excellent signposts in the sky. When you've done that, if you've got a pair of binoculars, try and find the constellation of Cygnus using Deneb as a guide, one of the members of the Summer Triangle. Work your way along the neck of the swan down to its beak and have a look at the star Albireo. Albireo is a double star and very, very colourful as well. One of the stars looks really orange colour and the other one very blue. So an excellent colour contrast against the blackness of the sky behind. And even a modest pair of binoculars will show that very nicely. Certainly any telescope will pick it up for you and show them as two separate stars and show you the colour. Also along the neck of the swan, if you've got a slightly more powerful telescope, I recommend an object that doesn't make it into Charles Messier's catalogue of things that annoyed him because they weren't comets, the good old M catalogue. And this is the Crescent Nebula. I don't know why he missed this one, but it's an excellent object to pick up. You can clearly see the bright crescent of the ring of gas that is expanding away from a very, very powerful star called a Wolf-Rayet star. So that's rather an unusual object and well worth having a look at. Of course, you've also got the Dumbbell Nebula, Messier number 27 in the little constellation of Vulpecula, which is not very far from Cygnus. Tends to be misidentified as being in Cygnus quite often, actually. And finally, while we're on the constellation of Cygnus, if you want something interesting to track down, look for the star 61 Cygni. This is Piazzi's flying star. It's one of the sun's near neighbours, only about 11 light years away. And it's a double star again, so binoculars will pick it up and show you that there are two stars very close together. And they're interesting because they are a pair of K-type dwarf stars, very long-lived, slightly smaller stars than the sun, orbiting around each other every 650 years and whizzing across our line of sight, partly because it's very close to us, but partly because the pair were both kicked out of a cluster of stars some millions of years ago and are travelling so fast that they're probably going to escape the galaxy completely, given enough time. They're moving with galactic escape velocity. So you can see these stars hurtling across the sky, and Piazzi, back in the 1800s, identified that they were changing position from year to year and realised that they were one of the fastest moving objects in the sky. So those are my objects, all really in the constellation of Cygnus for this month.
Good. Jonathan, on a slightly different tack, there's a story, I understand, about we're possibly observing the birth of a moon around a distant planet. What can you tell us about that, please?
Yeah, this is a fascinating story, and it's an example of where we're finding out more and more things. We talked about exoplanets on other programs, the study of exoplanets, we're looking at examples now where we're seeing fairly new stars still in their birth disk of material, and we're seeing planets being formed in the disk of material around new stars. We've now seen in the disk of material around the new planet being formed around a star, a moon being formed in the star as well. It's a disk of material around a distant planet called PDS 70C. It's about 370 light years from Earth. There are a number of planets have already discovered this ball, PDS 70B and PDS 70C. They always start the lettering system with B rather than A. So we have two planets which have been discovered. They're the only two planets we've found which are all still embedded in their circumstellar disk. And now we think we've actually confirmed that PDS-70C and maybe PDS-70B have also got circumplanetary disks of their own, circumplanetary disks rather than circumstellar disks. And we're starting to see the formation of moons in those disks. And this is fascinating because it also gives us some confirmation that this is the way in which planets, moon systems form. Because we've had lots of discussions and debates about how our moon has formed and where it's come from. If we actually see a moon being formed in conjunction with a planet that's being formed, that shows us one of the ways in which moons can happen.
Right. Well, thank you for that. I think we now start to look at what's ons. And in your association, gents, plus anything else in any of the other societies that we know round about. So, Paul, what's coming up in Cambridge?
From a Cambridge point of view, we've just got a couple of events this month. On the 20th of August, Friday at 8 o'clock, we've got Dr. Novak, who is talking to us about optical interferometry. So that's where you use more than one optical telescope and combine the light together and produce higher resolution images, much sharper, showing more detail than you would with a single telescope alone. A technique that was pioneered in Cambridge with the COAST instrument, which is actually still down at the Radio Telescope Observatory at Lord's Bridge. We've visited that a couple of times in the past with the Cambridge Astronomical Association. And then on the 28th of August, we've got our regular young astronomers group. And we will be talking about To the Edge of Space, which is all about the recent space missions of Virgin Galactic and Blue Origin with Sir Richard Branson and Jeff Bezos flying themselves up into space to become astronauts or not, depending on what NASA decides to do with the definition. I think, as you said, they're being very unfair, changing the rules afterwards.
I think
I think that the popular definition will be that anyone who makes it above the 50 miles probably gets to qualify to be an astronaut, regardless of what NASA say.
I think you're right, yeah.
So we've just got those two meetings this month, so taking it fairly easy. Hopefully we'll then kick off getting back to a bit more of a active program as we go into the new term and September onwards. And I think the same is true for the other societies. They're all pretty much on their summer break, so I couldn't really find anything that was going on other than St. Neots are having a couple of observing evenings, so maybe you can trot along and join them there.
So your events are going to be on video link, Paul, I presume.
Yes, I'm afraid that we are still going to be on Zoom, which is good in some ways because people can join us from all over the world and sometimes do. But it means that we're not back in person at the Institute of Astronomy anytime soon. I think the earliest that is likely to be is going to be in the start of the term after Christmas, in fact. But it might get brought forward. I'd rather work it that way than the other way.
Okay. Jonathan, can I just go back to something you've sent me? SpaceX will use a Falcon 9 rocket and Crew Dragon to launch the first all-civilian orbital mission known as Inspiration 4. That's coming up soon, is it not?
Yes, that's due to launch in September, I believe. So it's a little bit of early breaking news here. We know that SpaceX have actually, I think Jeff Bezos actually has got his first paying passenger to go around the moon. So there's going to be a lot of space tourism coming up. And so things are moving pretty quickly at the moment. We'll have to see where things go. But yes, this first orbital mission is a step forward from what we've seen recently with New Shepard and with the Virgin Galactic launches, because both of those were just ballistic launches. They went up and came down. So the first orbital mission means you actually have to put the spacecraft into orbit, which is a much bigger proposition. And if you remember the back to the origins of space travel, it was Gagarin who did the first orbit. But Shepard was the first American astronaut, but he didn't go orbital. He just did a ballistic trip. And it was John Glenn who was the first American to do an orbit. And I think actually the next spacecraft in the Jeff Bezos stable is actually called the New Glenn. So he's following through the list. And the third one, the New Armstrong. So we're wondering whether that's going to go to the moon.
Well, we'll see. And in the meantime, they're still working. I think they're making plans for that lunar portal. Can't think what it's called now.
The Artemis program.
The Artemis program, yeah.
They're putting together the rocket, which is the first Artemis 1 mission. That was supposed to be launching later this year. I haven't had any recent updates on that schedule. The idea was we had that launch this year, which would just be testing all of the technology in unmanned launch. We'd have Artemis 2, which would actually fly to the moon, but once again be unmanned, and that would go out in 2022-23. And then Artemis 3 would be a manned mission to actually land on the moon, and that's supposed to be in 2024. So that's the sequence of events. General belief is that lot will slip in time. However, Artemis 1 is being put together. It's passed all its tests and it's being assembled. So watch this space.
Indeed. Well, gentlemen, it's been a good show, as always. Thank you very much indeed for all your preparation and work. I do appreciate that very, very much. And I think we have to wrap up now. So that is this August edition of The Sky Tonight from HCR 104 FM, presented by me, Pete Singleton, with input and research from Paul Fellows and Jonathan Clough of the Cambridge Astronomical Association. Coming up at 10, it's The Late Show with Tony Obi, and following the news and local weather at 8, it's Rock and Roll with John Rea. So from all of us in this particular part of the universe, until next time, thank you, Paul, and thank you, Jonathan, and we wish you all a very good night, and we'll look forward to seeing you on Tuesday, the 7th of September, at 7 o'clock, as usual. So from all of us, a very good night. Good night.